looking at the future of infrastructure innovation here on the First Coast. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. You can also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, the future of infrastructure, this week's summit in the city. What are your questions and comments? What are your beefs about our infrastructure here in Florida? Call us up now, 549-2937. Then later, speaking of infrastructure, we'll tell you why this Rail Safety Week happening now is sending the alarm about avoiding danger around this area's many railroad track crossings. Plus, the Jaguars just can't get it done against Tennessee. Culpepper with that. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, Jacksonville is expected to spend some $3 billion in infrastructure improvements over the next 5 years. On Friday, October 5th, the Jacksonville Chamber will be hosting a summit that will bring together experts from around the world to talk about the really disruptive changes coming in technologies around energy, water, transportation, and city infrastructure. We're getting a preview right now as we welcome here in studio Carlton Robinson, the Chamber's Vice President for Entrepreneurial Growth. Good morning.
Thanks for having me, Melissa.
And on the line, we welcome Amin Tufani. He's the CEO of T-Labs in Silicon Valley and will be a keynote speaker at the conference. Amin, good to have you.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Cities of the future, what are your thoughts, questions, comments about infrastructure and how innovation is changing cities, including this one? Give us a call now, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page where we're already getting your feedback. Amin, lots of great speakers coming from all over the world, thought leaders like yourself at this summit. It's going to be a really informative event. Tell us a little bit about your talk. What will you be focusing on?
You know, my focus is on the impact of technology on how economies function. And ultimately, the truth is the pace of technological change is accelerating. We're seeing exponential growth in biotechnology, nanotechnology, solar technology, information technologies like artificial intelligence, Internet of Things, the blockchain. So the focus is on how will these technologies impact us as individuals, as business owners, and ultimately the entire ecosystems that we live in, including cities. And we call this topic exponential economics or exonomics.
Exonomics. So that's the new acronym. How would you define exonomics?
It's really revisiting a lot of the assumptions about economics, about how individuals optimize their choices, how business models operate, and how entire societies need to function in light of accelerating technological change. We noticed that a lot of assumptions from classical or neoclassical economics don't really hold anymore. And we need to revisit these assumptions, hence the approach by incorporating exponential technologies, accelerating technologies into the narrative and understanding the impact in the short term and also the long term.
We're talking infrastructure on the show. The city's JAX Infrastructure Innovation Summit is coming up the first week in October. What are your thoughts about the future of energy, transportation, water, the future of cities? It's 549-2937 to join us. Carlton Robinson, you're the Chamber's VP for Entrepreneurial Growth. What are some examples of these kinds of disruptions Amin is talking about that we are going to see on the ground here in our city? We have big infrastructure needs and problems nationally, of course, but here in Jacksonville as well. So what are some examples we could point to when you look at problems and solutions for our infrastructure?
I think the first thing for us is to realize where the opportunity is. And when we talk about infrastructure and innovation, the first thing is identifying what's our technology landscape. So what are the physical growth opportunities in energy, transportation, and water? And then on the other side of that, what can we learn from these speakers to create technology roadmaps for planning, selection, and innovation? Mm-hmm. Some of the top cities, Minneapolis, Seattle, San Francisco, some of the things that they leverage in terms of infrastructure are the bridges, trolleys, transportation. what will be important for us as a community is the more we engage with innovation, is converting that to entrepreneurial opportunities for small businesses and entrepreneurs. And that's where the industry opportunities will come in.
What would be an example of that?
One example would be in the financial services industry. So information technology, blockchain, those are opportunities for infrastructure from the innovation perspective.
549-2937 to join us now. Amin, Carlton just mentioned cities like Minneapolis, Seattle, and San Francisco, who are way out in front of a city like Jacksonville, Florida, in this space. Those are cities, I'm generalizing a little bit, but those are cities that are willing to tax themselves to improve their infrastructure. This is not a part of the country that's as willing to do that. So how does a city like Jacksonville get ahead on this issue where certainly the public is very upset about how far behind we are in terms of improving our grid, our infrastructure? But then there's this cognitive dissonance because people want improvements, but they don't want to pay for them, at least not in this city.
You know, it is a real issue, and it's something that needs to be included in the conversation. I think Jacksonville is uniquely positioned because the infrastructure is not fully built out. And, you know, that represents an opportunity because you do need to make these investments regardless. The point of this conversation is to align that investment, the $3 billion that you guys are expected to invest in infrastructure over the next 5 years, with technological development, some of which are already here, some of which are right around the corner, and anticipating the needs that are going to affect citizens and folks who live in the city, who, you know, with ultimately with the goal of business prosperity, improving quality of life. But we cannot have that conversation if we're not informed by technologists, by folks who are thinking about the impact of these technologies on entire societies. And including that conversation is imperative right now. That is what will align the investment that would happen otherwise
now,
with what the city would look like.
Right. Now, Carlton, a moment ago, we noted that the chamber estimates $3 billion are going to be spent on infrastructure improvements in Jacksonville over the next 5 years. Where is that money going to be spent?
Right now, from our perspective, the TPO and the authorities really...
The Transportation Planning Organization.
Transportation
JTA,
Planning Organization.
JTA, those groups.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Their capitalization of the different projects that they will invest in over the next 5 years really is reported back to us. And our goal, as we attempt to move towards a smart region, is to actively engage with those groups and identify the projects as they... Merch.
So we're talking everything from more high-speed buses to maybe more investment in the Skyway and rail. There are a lot of things, improvements to roads, improvements to sewer and water, all of that together?
Yes. And the two most popular items right now with JTA are the autonomous vehicle and then modernizing the Skyway.
Autonomous vehicle, meaning a car you don't drive. You just ride in it and it goes along without you steering it.
Yes.
Yeah. That's going to be amazing to see on our streets, isn't it? What are your thoughts about that and anything involved with transportation and infrastructure as we look ahead to October's Infrastructure Innovation Summit? It's coming up Friday, October 5th at the Prime Osborne. We're getting a little preview right now here on the show. Let's go to your thoughts, 549-2937. Stanley is in Jacksonville. Hi, Stanley. Good morning. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning. How you doing?
All right,
everyone?
Thanks.
Yes, there's also social engagement infrastructure, too, that we keep overlooking here in Jacksonville. And I keep talking about that because you have to have a tie-in. We keep talking about building Billings in Jacksonville, but we're not talking about the social engagement component that go along with everything. And because you need engaged community to make those things happen. And I'm not seeing that in Jacksonville. Thank you.
Okay, thanks for that. Amin, you know, just last week on this program, we talked about the 50th anniversary of the city and county governments consolidating in Jacksonville. And one of the negative outcomes of that has been that some neighborhoods in this city got left behind. 50 years later, they still don't have adequate streets, adequate sidewalks, adequate lighting, adequate sewer and water service. And the engagement, as Stanley pointed out, around improving the neighborhoods from an infrastructure perspective isn't always there. So as someone who sees the big picture on this, you speak all over the world. What about that social part of this and how that has been a problem here in this city?
You know, inclusion in this effort is paramount. That's why, you know, I've been quite impressed by the caliber of conversation that has so far happened in the planning of this event between the chamber and specifically a lot of conversations with the CEO of JEA, Aaron Zahn, and other folks from JTA and CPO. What I'm seeing that is very unique in that typically these types of events come together when there is one agency, one entity advocating for improvements to infrastructure, for leveraging technological innovation. But here, the conversation appears to be extremely inclusive. And I think this is the narrative that ultimately will lead to that social cohesion and inclusion that you're describing.
Carlton, your thoughts.
Well, I think we have a unique opportunity. Recently, we just completed our Elevate Northeast Florida, which over a 9-month period, we evaluated a lot of different sectors of our region and ways that we can improve Northeast Florida. When we think about social engagement and social impact in economic development, a big part of that is creating opportunities for inclusion. And so as we move towards more innovative activities, such as the conference, what we have to make sure of in terms of social inclusion is that we're converting a lot of this innovation into entrepreneurial opportunities. That's going to give us the most traction across the region to allow everyone to be included.
So you want business owners and entrepreneurs to register to attend this event?
Obviously, we'd want them to attend, but I think what happens on day two, what happens after for our community? And that's going to be a big part of my job is making mm-hmm. sure that as these opportunities arise, we're including that small business sector. And that's where we think more jobs and opportunity will emerge.
Okay. One more question for both of you. This is billed as the future of energy, the future of transportation, the future of water. That's in the headline here on the flyer for this event. The future of water. Now, I know, Amin, I don't think this is what you're focusing on in your talk, but I'm really curious to get your thoughts about that part of this event. What is the future of water? Because here in Florida, where we fight over water quite a bit, particularly Central Florida versus North Florida and our water resources, what's going to be on the agenda for this portion of the day, the future of water?
We're going to tackle that important question of water and its future by broadening the scope of the conversation. You know, if you look at water in isolation, the theme is always scarcity. But if you broaden the scope and include dialogue around infrastructure, around energy, for instance, the marginal cost of energy has been dropping exponentially. So if you do include things like solar in the mix, suddenly the conversation about desalination, about water distribution, shifts from that scarcity-driven model to an abundance model. And again, this is not going to be immediate, but in the shorter term, typically what we see is scarcity. But if you include new modalities for energy, including, very importantly, solar, where in a lot of parts of the world, the marginal cost of solar already competes and is more favorable than more conventional sources of energy, then suddenly the conversation around water turns into one of abundance. But again, that is a midterm to longer term view.
Lots of tweets about the infrastructure summit. Chad tweets the show, just like in our homes, we must have long-term investment in Jacksonville infrastructure. We can't skimp by and expect advancement. Politicians are too afraid to tell the truth to voters that we must invest in our future. Carlton, I know that's not probably the chamber line,
right,
but what about that feedback?
I think the main focus for us is to take a look at public investment. And the more public...
That's taxes.
It is taxes, but I think on the other side, that's us as small business owners and entrepreneurs bringing more money into the community.
Public-private partnerships on infrastructure, like toll roads that are P3s, cities around the country are experimenting with that. Is that the kind of thing you foresee?
I would defer to TPO on those types of decisions. I know what we've done in the most recent weeks is had an opportunity to take a look at the technology that they have at the TPO. So they're going to have a lot more information to make those types of decisions.
Lots of questions. Meanwhile, here are a few more tweets. How many bike lanes could be built for the cost of autonomous vehicles in this city? Susan tweets the show. How can future innovation and tech solve our ongoing problems like septic phase out and flooding? Amin, of course, last year after Hurricane Irma, this city experienced historic flooding. Many people around town still out of their homes, still trying to recover over a year later. Will that come up at all in this event?
Absolutely. We're taking a holistic view on the future of city. And, you know, the theme of a smart city is really driven by how do we optimize our resources? And we can't really optimize unless we're sensing what is going on in the city, in the physical environment in real time. That's why a key theme for the day is the, creating the digital twin of the city. And that is how, you know, we can go from current modes of optimization that tend to be subpar to levels where we're leveraging artificial intelligence and other technologies to sense what is going on in real time and preempt those types of disasters.
Okay, with all of that said, how can people register to be part of this summit, Carlton Robinson?
So to register for the summit, you have the website there?
Yeah, go to myjackschamber.com?
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, it's myjackschamber.com. It's the Jack's Infrastructure Innovation Summit coming up Friday, October 5th, all-day event at the Priam Osborne Convention Center with globally recognized speakers like Amin Tufani on the line for us. He's the CEO of T-Labs in Silicon Valley, a keynote speaker. Amin, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And also here in studio today, Carlton Robinson, the Chamber's VP for Entrepreneurial Growth. Have a great time.
Thank you, Melissa.
All right. Thanks, guys. Much more still ahead. Later, Culpepper has a look back at the Jags' loss at home to the Titans. Were you there? But up next, speaking of infrastructure, keeping you safe when you cross those railroad tracks, a word of warning this week from CSX and the Florida Highway Patrol. Back in a moment.
I'm Michelle Corum. Allow me to take about 30 seconds of your time, and that's about all it's going to be, as we get closer to our goal during the Radio Uninterrupted fall campaign. So far, you haven't had to miss a second of the programs you love. If you have already donated, thanks. If you have not, please don't wait. We could be finished with this in the next few days if everyone chips in right now. We need your support. Call 353-9528.
Hi, I'm Andrew Wickman, host of Blues Horizon. The best in classic and modern blues is now on twice a week. Blues Horizon, Monday and Wednesday nights at 11, right here on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, they're one of the biggest suppliers of boating products in this area, and so they're popular with our large boating population. In this episode of First Coast Success, Karen Bruni Mathis of the Jacksonville Daily Record speaks with Matt Bridgewater from Gem Products.
Boaters might not realize that their hardware is coming from a Jacksonville-based supplier.
Rod holders, steering wheels, hinges, those are what GEM Products supplies and has done so for 30 years. Matthew Bridgewater is the president and CEO, succeeding his father. His leadership included moving the company from Orange Park to a much larger custom-built location in Flagler Center in South Jacksonville. Matthew Bridgewater, welcome to First Coast Success.
Thank you for having us.
Tell us more about GEM Products. What do you do at the new Flagler Center headquarters, and what does GEM stand for?
So GEM Products is a design and engineering firm that designs predominantly stainless steel hardware, carbon fiber outriggers, and all the accessories that go onto a boat. We predominantly sell to boat builders throughout the United States, all over Europe and all over the Caribbean, and even into Australia and New Zealand. So we consider ourselves a core component supplier to boat builders.
And you said you designed those, and where are they made?
We do all the design and engineering and prototype here in Jacksonville. Much like Apple, our stuff is outsourced to Asia. We manufacture in China, Taiwan, Vietnam, and Thailand right now.
Now, your business not only reflects the economy, but you really are a leading indicator of what's coming in the economy. You knew the Great Recession was coming from how it affected your business. How is the economy now?
The economy is very strong and robust. It seems unquestionable that the tax cuts that were passed at the end of last year put a lot of money back into small business owners. That helped us amortize some of the costs on the new facility, some of the equipment purchases we made. And people that buy boats in many cases are part of or running in a small business. And so when they get a tax benefit, they tend to use that additional money either to buy equipment or to buy luxury items such as vacations or RVs or boats. So the boat building business is very strong right now.
What is the biggest challenge that you face?
The biggest challenge that we face right now is without question the Trump tariffs. It has been a very large disruption in our business. It's been a very large disruption into the boat manufacturing business. U.S. boat builders are one of the most successful made in America products. More boats are made in America than they are in the rest of the world combined. The reality is that the boats depend upon raw materials that come from overseas because that's where the factories are that make them. So there's been a huge disruption in just the confusion that it creates. We've got a great thing going in the marine industry right now. The RV industry is doing very well. And so to have these disruptions and unknowns in the supply chain has been very disrupting and now very costly.
Can you say how it has affected your business?
Well, the phase one of the tariffs was a tariff of 20 and 40% respectively on steel and aluminum. And that caused the boat builders, if you look at the T-tops for almost every boat, they're made out of aluminum. The structure that holds the molds together are made out of steel. So it was a tremendous hit because not only did they get a cost on the imported stuff, but all the domestic suppliers raised their price equally. So it was a direct hit to their bottom line. The phase two kind of came in. It didn't really do much. And then we have phase three kicking in on Monday. That's going to be very damaging. I mean, it's very disrupting. We've done everything we can to expedite shipments. Our freight forwarder made us pay the deposit for potential tariffs because we've got shipments on the water right now. So there's a huge financial cost to that up front. And it also unnerves the suppliers. We're fortunate that we manufacture in Taiwan and Vietnam, which have not been affected, and Thailand, which have not been affected. But the reality is the vast majority of stainless steel that for the marine industry comes from China, and the other countries are not set up to do it. So we don't know what's going to happen. I hope that both governments can come to a reasonable settlement.
What insights can you share about the Northeast Florida economy?
It seems very robust. I have employees who are moving from the west side over in Orange Park to the east side. They've had to put bids in on houses in order to just get one and have lost some of those bids. The housing market seems very strong. I think the economy here is very strong.
Well, Matthew Bridgewater, President and CEO of GEM Products, thank you for joining First Coast Success.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Karen. Well, planes, trains, and automobiles and railroad tracks. We are talking transportation of all kinds on the show today, it seems. You know, anyone who lives around town here in Jacksonville knows that at some point you are going to have to cross over railroad tracks. Most of us never think twice about it, but the truth is, every 3 hours in this country, a person or vehicle is hit by a train. Sometimes it can be deadly. This final week of September is National Rail Safety Week. CSX is teaming up with Florida Highway Patrol to blitz the area and raise awareness about rail safety. There's a lot you need to know. Here to fill us in, we're pleased to welcome Sean Doris. He is chief of the CSX Police Force. Chief Doris, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into the rail safety, let's pause for a moment and mark the fact that CSX has its own police force, which you run. I had no idea. I've lived here for a long time. There's still a lot to learn, I guess, about this city. You guys actually have your own police force. What does the CSX police force do?
So that is a common question. We get that at the beginning of most of these types of conversations. So CSX operates in the 23 states east of the Mississippi, and we have a police force operating in all of those, and I am responsible for that. All major railroads have a police force, and that's been something that's been in place since westward expansion, but most people don't really know much about it.
So you're there to just maintain public safety anywhere around the railroad tracks?
Correct. It's like a long, skinny city. We have all the same problems on the railroad that we have anywhere else in the nation.
Gotcha. Okay. With that said, this is National Rail Safety Week. Tell us about it. What is the purpose of this effort this week?
Sure. So Rail Safety Week is a nationwide initiative to raise awareness about the safety issues and how to operate safely around railroad tracks. And like you said, it is a joint operation mostly between the larger railroads, state and local government, nonprofits, schools, mm-hmm. et cetera, to kind of raise that safety level and make sure that people are paying attention when they operate around railroad tracks.
Now, on the CSX network alone, of course, CSX headquartered here in Jacksonville, you've got some 30,000 grade crossings on your network where trains and vehicles or pedestrians even can meet and cross paths. Often it can be dangerous. That's where the majority of the peril is, isn't it, at the grade crossings?
Correct. So we have two initiatives that we really focus on during this week. Again, the Rail Safety Week is obviously the entire week, but we've tried to focus on something a little different each day. But crossings and paying attention and distracted driving is one of those focuses. And then trespassing and walking along the railroad tracks is definitely one of the other focuses. So if we can kind of draw attention, make sure that people are paying attention to what they're doing when they cross those, then we feel pretty confident that we can eliminate the vast majority of most of those interactions.
Right. Common sense and following the rules can eliminate a lot of problems. But unfortunately, people don't always use common sense. So what are the most dangerous things people out there are doing? And what do you want to get people to stop doing?
Yeah. So as drivers, we want people with everything nowadays is distracting, of course, and distracted driving is a problem for a lot of different aspects. But we definitely want people to focus when they're approaching railroad tracks, make sure that, under no circumstances would they try to beat the train or go around an active crossing. But we also just want them to pay attention to the crossing in general and just not assume that the lights and crossing gates are your sole safety point. We kind of equate it to crossing a street. And that you would never just step out into the street without looking both ways. So we want to make sure that people do the same when they're driving. And then for parents, we want parents to make sure that they're talking to their children and making sure that they're not utilizing the railroad tracks as shortcuts or places to run or, access points for fishing or camping or using any of those things. Those are definitely problems for us. We've seen a real increase over the years with young people, especially using headphones and noise-canceling headphones and earbuds, and that is a significant problem for us.
You've also even noticed people like to take pictures of themselves on the train tracks. You want people to stop doing that because the train could come out of nowhere.
Absolutely. And like you said, you would think it would be a common sense, but we do see that a lot in professional photography, especially around prom time. Wedding season, we see a lot of staged camera photos or camera shots on railroad tracks. And it's amazing that people do it, but they do. And it can be tragic at times.
People shouldn't walk along the tracks either. I did not realize this. The train can overhang the tracks by up to 3 feet.
Correct. So we try to point out to, especially in school groups, that, if you're walking on the tracks or even near the tracks, very likely you're trespassing. which is not only dangerous but illegal. So we try to make sure that people are aware of that. And also, people don't realize how quiet trains can be. It's shocking sometimes to folks, but we look at all of these incidents that occur, and a lot of them that occur with headphones on. You know, people think that they would hear the train, and they just don't.
Anything else people need to know?
I would say if you want to look for more information, definitely go to CSX.com, and under the responsibility section on that website, we have lots of information about Rail Safety Week. And also, if they want to visit Operation Lifesaver and their website, they have tons of videos and information as well.
All right. He's Sean Doris, chief of the CSX Police Force. Yes, he is in uniform. They have a real police force. It's official. Can you arrest Jack DeYoung, the creator of the San Marco Train Twitter account, for me? He teases us all the time on his Twitter page. And, you know, you can make this stop. You have the authority. I'm just kidding.
Nah.
I'm just kidding, Chief. I'm just teasing you. But anyway, go to CSX.com. Follow them on Twitter as well for more about National Rail Safety Week. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We'll be right back.
WJCT's Fall Membership Drive is on right now, but this is not business as usual. We only have a few more days to reach our $60,000 goal. Donate today and support public media the way you like it, quickly, quietly, and without program interruptions. Help us minimize our on-air pledge drives. Make your gift count today. Whether you're renewing your support or making a donation for the very first time, do it at wjct.org/radio. Thanks.
Welcome back. Well, a quick programming note. We invite everyone to come on out this Friday, September 28th, to WJCT's big and first ever block party in Five Points. That's right. We are saying goodbye to summer, hello to fall in one of the city's most vibrant neighborhoods all day and into the night. We're going to kick things off at 9 a.m. with a live broadcast of this show, live from Derby on Park. Some people will be there having breakfast with us. And then the block party continues all through the day in Five Points and into the night with a live broadcast of our own Electro Lounge coming to you from right there in the neighborhood. Now, the big block party in Five Points is free. Some vendors are chipping in with a portion of sales from the day benefiting WJCT. So if you come out and spend money in the neighborhood, you are helping public radio on the First Coast stay strong and vibrant. Special thanks to our lead sponsors, Bread and Board and Derby on Park in Five Points, two amazing local restaurants over there. So make sure to come by Five Points this Friday. Just come by at some point during the day or evening. It's our first ever WJCT block party, saying goodbye to summer, hello to fall. In Five Points, support public radio on the First Coast. We will see you there this Friday. Well, if at first you don't succeed, try again. You've heard that, right? That old adage is at the core of Epic Fails. It's a popular middle grade nonfiction book series by co-authors Eric Slater and Ben Thompson. The books focus on well-known historical ventures that took some time to get off the ground. Everything from the Wright brothers' first flight to the race to space, and more. Now, Eric Slater hails from Green Cove Springs, and he's here in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. Your co-author, you. Ben Thompson, is on the line from the West Coast. Ben, good to see you on the show.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us on here.
Okay, so you live on opposite sides of the country, but you've teamed up for this very successful book series. How did this happen, Eric?
That's a good question. So we were both fans of each other's work. We both have our own history blogs, and I was actually going to Ben for advice on pitching this concept, and we ended up collaborating on it.
And you did that remotely, him on the West Coast, on the East Coast?
The funny thing is we didn't actually meet in person until our first book signing back in July. We've been working on this since 2016.
Wow. And so, Ben, you met at the launch party for Epic Fails at the Bookmark here in Neptune Beach. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah, we were we had worked and we had, been talking on IM and on the phone and sending drafts back and forth. And we wrote this book over the course of, wrote the first two books over the course of like a year. And we were supposed to meet maybe like 10 minutes, but we were supposed to meet like a half hour before the reading. And then he ended up getting stuck in traffic. So it was like, hey, I'm Eric, I'm Ben. We got to go do this book reading together.
Oh my gosh. It's amazing how people can work remotely with each other so successfully. You guys are a great example of that. And these are books that middle schoolers are reading, I guess, now all over the country. Or at least in some schools. So how did you come? How did you hit upon this concept, Epic Fails? And these are true historical ventures that people tried and failed and tried and failed, and then they eventually were successful.
So it's a humorous look at history. We tried to keep it interesting, but it's mostly about all the crazy mishaps that happen along the way to success. And I think it's an important lesson for kids that. Everyone makes mistakes, and it's all about learning from those mistakes. It's about perseverance and not giving up.
So, Ben, tell us about the launch titles that you debuted this summer. The Wright Brothers, Nosediving into History, and The Race to Space, Countdown to Liftoff. Those are the first two in the series, right?
Yeah, exactly. So they kind of tie together pretty well because you start with them. We start with a lot of the fails and the crashes and everything that came up leading up to the first human powered flight. And then from there, we go on in the second book, we start talking about the space program and all of the mishaps and things, kind of speaking to what Eric said, it's like, we had the first two plane crashes before we had that first actual plane flight, right? And the first time we tried to fire a rocket into space, it blew up on the launch pad. Hmm. And it's a good thing for kids where, it's like, anybody that has ever been successful or done anything amazing in the world, they messed it up about 100 times before they got it right. And so it kind of is a good way to like be like, it's okay. You're allowed to make mistakes. Just keep going. You just don't give up on them.
That's right. And the middle grades, I think, is the ideal time to get that message because middle school is a tough time. Is this a way for you to teach kids, but also kind of give them a positive message that you've got to have some grit and resilience to succeed? Because that leap from elementary to middle school, I know I've seen this in my own household. It's hard.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
So Ben, what about that?
Like middle school is tough. Middle school is a tough time, right? You've got a lot of stuff changing. You've got a lot of, it's a real different experience in elementary school. You're not a kid anymore. You're growing up. And you know what? You're going to go to the wrong classroom. You're going to not get your homework done correctly. There's going to be a lot of things. You've got a lot of challenges and adversity, adversarial situations that you're running into that are new. And it's okay. Everybody has messed up. Everybody has failed. The most famous skateboarder in the world crashed, a billion times before he like landed that jump, right? It's okay to mess up. It's okay to fail. And the people who ended up being successful, they didn't let that slow them down, right? Like, it's okay, you can keep going, and eventually, like, you get it.
Sure. Now, these books have been very well reviewed because you both are very knowledgeable historians, but you inject a lot of humor into these, and you don't talk down to the kids. How important was that to you in writing these?
I think that was essential. We really wanted to make it down to earth and relatable. These people we often put on pedestals, they were just like us, they made mistakes and, pushed on through.
Yeah, pushed on through.
Yeah, and then, you know, for the way you want to tell the stories, right, it's like, okay, this is really cool history stuff, but when you hear the Wright brothers, you don't always think, like, you don't think, oh, this is going to be a really exciting action movie, right? Like, well, this is a really interesting story. There's a lot of really cool stuff that happened to these guys, and there's a lot of cool things that they went through. And we wanted to tell these stories of historical figures, and it's nonfiction, it's all true stories. We don't change the history at all, but we wanted to read more like an adventure novel than like a... than a real boring history book. So it's like, here's the cool stuff that happened. Here's, like, you know, the second time that the Wright brothers went down to Kitty Hawk, they were getting sand in their face, and a mosquito swarm descended on them and ate them so bad that, like, it ate their underwear off of them while they were wearing it. Right?
I'm like, kidding. I didn't know that. I grew up in Dayton, yeah. Ohio, and I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah, well, it's like, yeah, so, you know, well, what they needed to make the planes work was they needed a lot of open ground. They went off a sand dune because they didn't want to jump from too high of an area, and they needed wind. So they're on a beach in the heat, in the wind, getting sand blown in their face, and they're trying to camp out here over the course of like a week. And, you know, it becomes almost like a survival adventure story about these guys trying to make it on the beach by themselves and build this airplane and do something that nobody's ever done before. And, you know, that's a really cool story. And I think a lot of people that write history, they lose sight of why they fell in love with the story to begin with. And,
yeah.
And they can make it very boring and very dry and very dull. But, like, these are really interesting stories. And I think that we tried to, hopefully, we told them in a way that makes it come across that way.
Now, your new installments, this one caught my eye. The next epic fails is called Not So Great Presidents, Commanders in Chief.
I should point out that it's historical presidents.
In recent years. Okay.
Yeah.
So who makes the not so great president list in the Epic Fails series?
So we actually covered as many as we could. We ended up having to cut for word count, but we really wanted to focus in on a lot of the failures that presidents overcame. We did talk about some of the ones that didn't quite work out, but... even like Abraham Lincoln and George Washington, they
had failures. Sure.
Exactly.
And so you had your big book launch in July at the Bookmark. This is an ongoing series. Where can parents get these books for their kids? Are anywhere books are sold?
Pretty much. They're available on Amazon, Books A Million, Barnes & Noble.
Very cool. And go ahead, Ben.
Oh, I was going to say anywhere you can find books, you can get them. They're available on Kindle. They're available on Amazon, all that stuff.
And we recently found out they are doing an audiobook version.
So. Very nice. It's the Epic Fail series for middle schoolers. The co-authors are Eric Slater here from the First Coast and Ben Thompson from the West Coast. He's on the line this morning. He got up very early for us. They're collaborating across the country. Are you using Slack? That's what we do when we have to work remotely with people. But it's amazing what we can do today. So best of luck with it, guys. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much for having us on the show.
Speaking of epic fails, the Jaguars just couldn't get it done yesterday against the Titans. Culpepper with that right after this. Keep listening.
Clinic, committed to delivering the world-class care only Florida's top hospital can provide. Learn more at mayoclinic.org/Florida.
Ansbacher Law. Florida law imposes strict time limits on claims for construction defects. Barry Ansbacher is Florida Bar Board certified in construction law and real estate law. More at 737-4600 or ansbacherlaw.com.
Become a WJCT sustainer now and help eliminate the kind of fundraising that interrupts your favorite programs. Make a monthly gift of $5 or more to invest in journalistic integrity, quality storytelling, and local perspective. Help us keep your public radio uninterrupted by becoming a sustainer right now at wgct.org/radio or calling 353-9528. And thanks.
The book Before His Time, The Untold Story of Harry T. Moore, America's First Civil Rights Martyr, is being published in a new edition with updated material. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with author Ben Green. We'll discuss Florida Highways Magazine and automobility in the Jim Crow era. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
The Me Too movement feels like it's just getting started. How should we treat the men whose careers are finished? Some of those who have abused and bullied others have started what you might call a comeback tour. When should we end their exile? If ever. Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally, this hour, the Jaguars just couldn't find the end zone in Sunday's loss to the Titans.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper, wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Okay, so coming off that elation of beating the Patriots, what happened against Tennessee? Culpepper's here now with his thoughts. You know, they've always had trouble with Tennessee, haven't they?
They really have. And if you think about it, Melissa, last year, the Jaguars didn't score a touchdown and a meaningful time of the game with the offense against the Titans. They scored a defensive touchdown of the game at the end of the year in Nashville and didn't score until the game was well in hand for the Titans early on here in Jacksonville. So it's three straight games the offense hasn't gotten it done against the Titans. I asked Doug Marrone after the game. He said he was expecting this kind of physical, grinded out game right from the get-go. I think there were some mistakes made for sure. But Tennessee is a matchup problem for the Jaguars because the Jaguars are a physical team that likes to overpower the opposition. Tennessee's the same kind of team, and they're willing to play the ugly game, which is exactly what happened. Consider just a couple of numbers here. Last week, the Jaguars averaged 7 yards per offensive play against the New England Patriots. This week, 4.1, so almost half there. Last week, Blake Bortles threw for 377 yards. Yesterday, less than half that, 155 through the air. Quite frankly, the Jaguars should win every game they play when they hold a team to 9 points. It's inexcusable for an offense to do what they did yesterday. Now, here are some excuses saying that it's inexcusable. They did not have Leonard Fournette. They did not have their left tackle Cam Robinson, who's done for the year with an injury. They did not have right guard A.J. Cann, who was out with an injury. So were they limited a bit? Sure. But two field goals is all? Their best scoring opportunity really came when Malik Jackson knocked Blaine Gabbert, who started at quarterback, out of the game, and they recovered a fumble, but it was overturned because of a helmet-to-helmet hit by Jackson on that play. So if the Jaguars hadn't had the penalty, they would have had it in pretty good field position there. After the game, I went into the locker room and talked to a number of the players, and it was interesting to hear how they were responding. Telvin Smith and Calais Campbell talked about how the Jaguars handled and will handle this loss.
We came back in the locker room and guys expressed emotion. You know what I mean? It's not like guys got quiet. Ain't nobody shy away from it. Things were said. So, not this team.
You know, this one stings a little bit because it's a division game at home. You know, but at the end of the day, it's just one loss. And how we respond is really what it comes down to. And I'm very confident this team will respond.
Chances are they will respond. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if you go 2-1 every three games, you're going to have 10 or 11 wins. You're going to be in the playoffs. It's going to be fine. It's the way they lost, and that they lost in what everybody was saying, hey, is this going to be a letdown game after the big win over the Patriots, as you were mentioning? It was just one of those things that everybody kind of looked at and went, oh, well, they've got to be able to deal with it. It was a letdown in some regard. I thought it was a letdown in the stadium. The energy wasn't nearly what it was against New England. Mm-hmm. It was hot, not as hot as it had been the week before, but it was like somebody just let the air out of the balloon.
So they've got to come back another game in this three-game homestand next week against the Jets.
Another team they should be motivated for. Remember, the Jets beat them last year.
Okay, let's talk college football. The Gators going through some transitions, Cole says.
Well, and certainly they're going through a major transition as well in Tennessee. So the win by the Gators on Saturday against the Volunteers, which was 47-21, has to be put in a little bit of context. But I think it was a step forward for Florida. They're now 3-1 on the year. It was their first conference win under Dan Mullen. They forced turnovers, and then they did something with them. The Gators now lead the nation in turnovers forced. So next up, they're on the road again, traveling to Starkville to face Mullen's old team, Mississippi State, on Saturday. Meanwhile, FSU got the win, so the Noles fans can breathe a little bit of a sigh of relief. At least for a while, FSU handled their business at home against Northern Illinois 37-19 to even their record at 2-2. Big day for DeAndre Francois, the quarterback, threw for over 350 yards. Seminoles, though, still looking for their first win over a Power 5 conference team. They can get it Saturday on the road in conference play at Louisville.
Nice. And Georgia undefeated.
They're rolling. Right now, Georgia is the best team in the country, not named Alabama. And, of course, so you've got the two best teams in the country in the SEC. They took out Missouri on the road. They will host Tennessee Saturday. That should be an easy win at home in Athens.
Okay. Before we wrap things up, you want to talk a little bit about Tiger Woods.
Remarkable. A year ago, Tiger wasn't even sure that he would ever play professional golf again. And today, he's waking up as the winner of the Tour Championship, the last event in the FedEx Cup playoffs. A Tiger needed to win the Tour Championship and have six other things happen for him to win the FedEx Cup Championship and the accompanying $10 million bonus check. He didn't get all those things to happen, but he was impressive in winning on the PGA Tour. His first win in over 5 years, wow. 1,876 days since his last win on tour.
What do you attribute this comeback to?
A lot of it is physical. He's healthy. He's gotten his body back into shape. And the other thing that's interesting, he has gotten rid of every coach. He is now coaching himself, and it seems to be working out for him.
Trusting his own best judgment.
That's right.
How about that? Okay, well, follow Cole on Twitter for all your sports news and notes. Listen to him every Monday on this show, and always good to see you. Thanks for being here. Have a great week.
Thanks, Melissa.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Kevin Murchart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. Our theme composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. If you missed any portion of today's show, just catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening to 89.9. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.